Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our friend Wilton Barnhart, who teaches writing as a professor over at North Carolina State University, is now more famous for being the author of a New York Times bestselling book, Look Away, Look Away. We'll talk some about the book, but what I've asked him to come talk about is a workshop that he's doing at the North Carolina Writers Network fall conference this year. It's in Charlotte, which happens to be the same site as he sets his comic bestseller. And he's going to talk about a workshop called The Comic Touch. Wilton Barnhart, welcome.
Well, thanks. Happy to be here.
What's The Comic Touch?
Well, it's taken me a long time to wear the mantle of comic writer. I was afraid that if I actually said I'm sort of funny and my books are sort of funny, that they would immediately not become funny, or I'd lose whatever ability I had to make anybody laugh. But I guess four books in, I will admit, I guess I can be amusing. And I would never have volunteered to say one word on this topic. This was sort of selected for me, and I said, "Yeah, let's do it. Let's see if I can teach anybody." And it's dubious whether you can teach anybody anything about writing anyway. But let's not go on too long about that. I have a job as a MFA professor over at NC State. But it's hard. It's a little like unicycle riding, I guess, if you thought about it. What you're actually doing too long, you might not be. I think most funny people are naturally funny, and maybe they themselves don't know why they're being funny when they're being funny. But I gave it some thought. I got out the legal pad and started thinking about, well, what is funny in literature, and what works, and when my students try something that isn't funny, or I try something that isn't funny, why isn't it funny? And it's so I've been thinking about this for a while. They'll get the benefit of lots and lots of thought. I'm not sure any other benefit will be derived from this class.
Where did you go to think? I mean, what kinds of you've taught writing, and you're a great writer, so you've read a lot. So you sort of – did you just sort of – I'm thinking about, well, when was Shakespeare funny? When was it – when did it work? Or thinking about more the modern writers who really deliberately write? Where'd you go?
Well, the first insight I had into it is that not everybody thinks everything is funny. And, I've got lots of examples from my own work, things I thought was just screamingly funny that nobody laughed at or nobody thought was nice at all. I think a lot of the great comic writers try everything. They just throw everything at the wall. The Mark Twains or David Sedaris, they're funny in many different ways, you know. But I think there are probably some main categories of funny that never fail. I think probably one of the tried and true ways is the coming of age story. I think the coming of age story never fails to amuse. I can't think of anybody from, you know, Dickens or Rita Mae Brown's Ruby Fruit Jungle. I mean, the most diverse array of writers. But when you start talking about young people trying to make their way in the world, it's all kinds of comedy shows up because of their naivete.
But is it just sex? Is it just their messing around and trying to figure out how all that works that leads to many embarrassing and therefore comic moments?
Well, so sex is right up there for, follies. But there's, the larger romantic follies, or being at the very bottom of an organization, or being the assistant to somebody that needs such pampering and help to get through the day, a boss or somebody that you're perhaps even doing the work for. I just think the kind of things that are dealt to you when you're at the very bottom of the ladder are funny. You wouldn't want to do it your whole life. But my first book, Emma Who Saved My Life, is one of those coming-of-age books, and it follows the adventures of three artistes, a poet, a painter, and an actor. And of course, they have nothing but bad luck in New York, and their breakthroughs are paltry when they do have a breakthrough. And they all come to realize maybe maybe they've had their run at it and it's time to go home, but not before they've had a lot of adventures. And I've been told it's funny. Actually, I didn't think I was being all that comic when I wrote it, but as I looked back, and of course many of the incidents were based on my own experience, it was funny. It was funny. But that's a whole category. Called a warm, gentle kind of comedy. Now, another more, aggressive kind of comedy is based on the intemperate voice. The intemperate voice.
What do you mean by that?
Well, let's think about, you know, Mark Twain and Innocence Abroad. He's determined not to enjoy the opera. He's determined not to endure without complaint the Turkish bath. You know, this is somebody who we come to like his irascible, grouchy voice. We find much in it. I think probably I don't know how many readers out there have ever run across Tobias Smollett's 18th century's visits to France and Italy. He begins on the premise that he hates France and he hates Frenchmen. And the only thing worse than a Frenchman is an Italian. He hates the food. He hates the fashion. He hates the palaces. He hates the cathedral. It's a hate book. This grouchy Englishman goes all across the continent. And I imagine 18th century travel left a lot to be desired. Think of, carriages mired in the mud between provincial towns. And think of the hotel situation. It must have been pretty rough to travel, but anyway, he hates it. He just hates everything for page after page. And but you never tire of reading him complain about things. He's just an irascible, fun complainer. So I think the intemperate voice can give you in my book, Look Away, Look Away, I have Gaston Jarvis, this sort of highly successful, best-selling, schlocky writer.
A big jerk, but very successful.
Very big jerk. I kept thinking people were just going to hate him. I tried to make him as loathsome as possible, and people ended up liking him. But he is utterly intemperate, and he just has, he has enemies behind every corner, even people who he hates his readership. You know, he thinks they're fools. And there's a scene where Charlotte Magazine. I'm not sure there is a Charlotte Magazine. Yeah. Is there one?
There used to be, yeah.
There used to be. Anyway, Charlotte Magazine is doing one of those 10 writers of Charlotte, new voices of Charlotte. And he's incredibly offended that he, a best-selling author of Civil War potboilers, is not included somehow in this. And he pretends to be his own personal assistant. And he calls up the magazine to try to arrange, and surely Mr. Jarvis is going to be included in the 10 writers who matter. Of course, it's all about up-and-coming talent. It's not about him. And he just keeps, running at this castle, trying to get into this article. It's so petty. It's so small. Why would a millionaire, many times over, best-selling author care about what Charlotte Magazine is saying? But he does care because he's intemperate and grouchy, and he never lets a score go unsettled. And of course, he loses. All of these battles for deference, for honor, are all doomed to fail.
Well, you make us is this sort of a idea that we gain some pleasure, comic pleasure, out of the torture that characters have to go through, that we say this is a jerk, and so it's good, it's funny that he gets beat around a little bit.
Yes, I think so, and I think comedy comes from some extent to, I guess we laugh in slapstick when someone takes a broom handle to the face or slips on the banana peel.
The schadenfreude was the word I was trying to get at.
Yeah, yeah.
That we take, that we may apologize for this, but we have to confess that we really like sometimes to enjoy the tough times that some other person, particularly if it's not a likable person, is going through.
Oh,
I'm so sorry that you lost your job.
I think that's right. I think, though, at the same time, some of that comedy, some of the success of that comedy in Smollett or Mark Twain, or perhaps when Gaston is having a, rant about Charlotte Magazine. But we've all been petty about something. We've all felt passed over. We've all felt like things should have been made better for us, even though we're not grand personages. And we can smile at ourselves a little bit. I think if we didn't recognize that horrible feeling. The thing about these characters, and I think Twain probably enjoyed himself immensely at the Turkish bath. He was entertaining us with his reminiscences. I think part of that is we enjoy vicariously having the temper tantrum that we wouldn't have. We're better behaved than some of the people we read about.
We're going to take a quick break. We're visiting with Wilton Barnhart, the author of Look Away, Look Away, giving us some insight into comedy and humor based on a workshop that he'll be teaching at the upcoming winter conference of the North Carolina Writers Network. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Wilton Barnhart. He's the New York Times bestselling author of Look Away, Look Away. And for some people, that was a funny book, or they had lots of funny things in it. Some people got mad at it.
Yeah, if you could get past my first chapter, I think you probably enjoyed the book. I keep hearing from book clubs, the ones that did and did not survive the first chapter, which of course set right here in Chapel
yeah,
Hill.
Tell us about that. I mean,
during Rush Week.
We had this argument about this, and I said, Wilton, this is a date rape or a rape scene amidst the drunken fraternity sorority parties. And I said, you overdid that. And you remember what you told me? You said, I can document every bit of it.
Well, it's true. I mean, that's just one element of a fabulous array of fraternity and sorority behavior, much of which is now getting a lot of attention in the news. I didn't make anything up. I knew that some hardcore Chapel Hill partisans would say, oh, you're a state and you're just trying to make fun of our institution. Well, of course, that's true. But secondly,
we got this confession on the record, Dan.
Yeah, I know. Of course, I'm making fun of Chapel Hill. But I made fun of Raleigh, too, and Greensboro and Charlotte. Everything I touched, I tried to abuse. But no, it's set among the really rich, really irresponsible fraternity and sorority set, Rush Week. And this is also set about 10 years ago, about the time that people were getting arrested for cocaine distribution in the fraternity houses. And so there's all kinds of bad sex behavior, but there's other kinds of bad behavior too, the hazing. And I think it's funny. I suspect there's some sweet teetotaling book clubs that would not have wanted to read all that. But every single thing I put in there, I got out of off websites and blogs and newspaper articles and serious books about the kind of things that go on at Chapel Hill.
Well, there's an idea, I think, about comedy and humor that the best of it has to be set in tragic or tough or uncertain, you know, tough times. It works better when it's in the middle of something bad and gives you some relief from that. But in the middle, how do you make date rape comic?
Well, I don't make that particular comic, but I think fraternity rituals and I also made fun of the prim sororities. They wouldn't be any fun either. I suspect the reader's going, well, she could have gone to the nice one, but that looks so darn dull. You might as well go where the party girls are. Okay, you bring up a very interesting point that, it's the difference between, okay, people go to, I don't guess he's as popular as he used to be, or an Adam Sandler movie or a Jim Carrey movie, and it's just farcical and naughty and bathroom humor. But then you think about a film by Charles Chaplin. There's always some element of pathos to the greatest comedy. There's something that it's you. There's a moment where you wonder if you ought to be laughing or crying. Right? Right. The very strongest comedy partakes of that, and the most humane comedy. So I think you can take a very very serious topic and get comedy out of it. I don't know if you ran across this is last year. Boris Fishman. You ever read this?
No, I missed it.
A replacement life. It's one of those books that I think expertly does this. It got wonderful reviews. He's a first novelist. He's writing about, I mean, in the end, what the book contains in it is scamming the German government for Holocaust reparation money. He's got all these old, Belarusians and Ukrainians in this neighborhood in Brooklyn he grows up, and it starts off him trying to, his grandmother dies before he's able to apply and get this money. So he sort of pretends she's still alive to get this money. And then others in the neighborhood, some of whom are clearly not Holocaust survivors. I mean, how outrageous is that? That's completely appalling. And yet it's a way of yet again looking at the Holocaust and at the history. And it's not, despite the comic overlay, it's really not disrespectful, or rather, maybe that's not quite right. It is disrespectful, but in a larger, serving a larger purpose of reuniting us with the serious issues of the Holocaust. So, I mean, if you make a Holocaust comedy book, I mean, what can't you do? You know, it seems to me it's a way into any number of very, very serious topics. And I think that there is often the element of the appalling, you know, in comedy.
Let me, you're on a roll. I hate to interrupt you, but this idea of setting comedy in the middle of a Holocaust, even just mentioning Holocaust, reminds me that there is a risk in comedy that somebody, and particularly in this situation, will just say absolutely, that's holy ground, you don't trample on that, or that everybody has their piece that don't make fun of that or don't set this, so that in forming your tragic situation out of which you build a comedy, you got to worry all the time that somebody's going to think you're making fun of the situation rather than developing the comedy out of it.
Well, I suspect publishers have, you know, if you don't pull these kind of things off, I imagine there are plenty of, missed opportunities or books that missed the boat that tried to be funny about war. War's not funny. You know, war is pretty savage. But look at MASH. Look at Catch-22. Mm-hmm. Joseph Fowler's Catch-22 is very, very funny. Yeah. But it's also, you know, PTSD, war injuries, the madness of war. That's not funny at a certain level. But it can still be made subject to comedy.
Well, you write a book. You could, 100 years ago in the South, you could write a book and make a lot of comedy out of racial matters. But if you tried to make a parody out of slavery or bad race relations today, you'd be walking a tightrope. Mark Twain probably would have had trouble with this kind of humor.
You don't agree?
Yeah. Come on back.
I hate to say there's nothing you couldn't make funny. And I can think of I need my whole library sitting in my office. I'm getting, as I get older,
We'll do the next interview at your place.
Yeah, let's do it at my office. Percival Everett has a wonderfully funny book that is, of course, he's a black writer, and he pretends to be a super, hip-hop, inner-city kind of writer in order to gain popularity, and it's a white person couldn't have written this, but I don't know that there's anything off base. Mm-hmm. I think it's all a matter of, did you make us laugh and did you make us think? And if those things are achieved, I think you probably get a pass. But let's face it, there'll always be somebody who'll sweep in and say, this is inappropriate, this is not the subject comedy.
Yeah, that's where I get, some of us are so sensitive that one objection on the basis of not being politically correct or doing something would knock us off balance. So a writer has to be prepared, if he or she is dealing with comedy, that just be ready. Somebody's going to be offended. Someone's and they're gonna not going to get the humor.
Yeah, that's right. And it's the Lenny Bruce thing, right? I mean, somewhere in one of the David Sedaris, I think, is just almost unfailingly funny. He has a piece about pretending to be a paralyzed vet or something at one point. He's sitting in a wheelchair begging for money fraudulently. That shouldn't be funny. And it's so outrageous. I wonder if he even really did it. It's so outrageous. But it's part of comedy has to be outrage. You have to, you know, you have to have your eyes go wide for a second and your eyebrows go up and you went, oh my God, that can't really be what he's expressing. And if you think about our favorite stand-up comics, they often are right on the line. You know, Richard Pryor at his best, or Chris Rock at his best, or as I mentioned, Lenny Bruce as well, George Carlin. There's real, you know, edge. There's acid. There's real social commentary at the edge of that comedy. In fact, they can achieve certain kinds of social commentary that would probably be dreary if it was just in prose political speech form.
Well, if they do this on the radio now, they're going to be thrown off the radio. Right. I mean, and not just talking about the language, you know, the bad language, but about the images of running, making fun of people and making fun of sacred cows and stuff like that, that it happens all the time that somebody says something that maybe was wrong or something like that, but we jump on them and force them out.
We do, and it's interesting to see that there are, say, shock jocks or writers who can be quite outrageous, comics that can be quite outrageous that we don't expect to. I mean, Howard Stern somehow has managed to stay on there, not have to do the continual apology circuit the way Don Imus, you know, had to or something. And he's just as bad as anyone. And I think the reason why Howard Stern perhaps doesn't get in trouble, or any number of writers, comics that I could mention, is because we like them. We understand their sensibility. You know, there are some people who, I guess we're not really talking about stand-up comics, but there's some comics that probably never made you laugh once. But a lot has to do with sensibility. In the same way that I don't think, you know, Mark Twain is being, you know, bitter or mean about all these European countries, or the fat lady singing at La Scala, I get his sensibility. He's a tired traveler who's too hot, who hasn't had a good meal, who hasn't had a good
bowel movement. And he's not going to pretend to enjoy it.
Right. He's not going to pretend about it. I see myself now as an older traveler, you know, in Twain. And I think not only we're mentioning the intemperate voice, but there's also there's something about unbalance that's funny.
What do you mean by
something like Portnoy's Complaint? That is a very funny book by Philip Roth. We won't scandalize the few people who don't know what it's about by going into too much detail about it, but of course it's a monologue from a man who can't live without, shall we say, self-abuse. And it's absolutely, you know, hilarious, but it's unbalanced. Confederacy of Dunces has as the center of it a hero that's completely nuts, so that's completely unbalanced. I think David Foster Wallace's a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again. There are rants in there. He's the most neurotic narrator ever. There's rants about the suction toilet, like in planes or in cruise ships, and how, you know, he imagines, you know, his digestive tract sucked into the toilet, and, you know, just he's scared and neurotic about everything, diseases. And you think about the neurotic comedy of Woody Allen, you know, early Woody Allen before he became, you know, serious and important. Those really funny early movies, it's all neurosis. It's all and that's unbalanced. But because they're so scared of everything, we can laugh at it because we have our own collections of neuroses.
Well, right now, I mean, everybody is beginning to be scared of Ebola and getting it.
Not a bad thing to be scared of.
And so you're going to have somebody tries to make a joke about it. And maybe it would be maybe be funny. But somebody's going to say, no, we can't. This is so serious.
I think the late night comedians are making Ebola jokes. And we're doing a lot of that whistling past the graveyard. Somebody coughed the other day in a meeting and said, if you have Ebola, please sit in the back of the room. And everyone laughs. Not because it's funny, but that's one of our mechanisms, right? Mm-hmm. It's one of our mechanisms to not worry about. We all know that
there's somebody in that meeting who's saying, that's not appropriate. This is a serious business.
I'm sure somebody is probably at that meeting thinking that.
It's a group of – well, here. I'm getting myself in trouble, and I'm going to save myself by taking a break. Visiting with Wilton Barnhart. the author of Look Away, Look Away. We're talking about comedy in writing and literature. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Wilton Barnhart, who is going to be leading a work, not only giving a speech, but we're talking about the workshop he's going to be giving on comic, on the role of the comic in literature. We've been talking about it, and you've been talking about serious stuff. I mean, this is high-level comedy in pathos.
Right.
But is there a place in writing for a little bit of slapstick, for inserting, you know, comedy routines and funny?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. In fact, I think the really funny books and the really funny authors are able to make use of all the different kinds of comedy. And at a certain point, I mean, if Shakespeare could do low puns and James Joyce could do low sex puns and bathroom function puns, then, you know, if they can do it, can't we do it? And I think the equivalent of slapstick, the equivalent of the Three Stooges, you know, walking into a door or something, is probably just, you know, crude, juvenile humor. And it's funny to watch, you know, really sophisticated authors do this, but occasionally it's a note that needs to be sounded. And God knows, if you listen to my mother, I have been guilty of that in each and every book. There has been something that's just offensive or just puerile. That's the word I keep getting, is puerile. But, you know, we're like this. We're tired at the end of the day, or a couple is having a fight about something silly, or that this kind of stuff comes up. I don't know. I don't know, you know, what the FCC would say. Perhaps next break I should check, because I want to tell a particular story. But yeah, every once in a while, after a run of particularly sophisticated comedy, it really helps to have. And Emma, who saved my life, I have a they call this agent that they really don't like very much. They depend on her for life and for getting them roles and getting them auditions.
These are, just for those who hadn't read that book, these are people looking for work in the
theater. And she's an agent, and she's not particularly attractive. And they have little names for her that are completely crude. And at some point, one involving the word anus, that's as far as I'll go, she has this way of putting on lipstick. And she wears this, they can't quite figure out why she has this sort of brown, dark lipstick. And when she puts her lips together to put on this lipstick and then smacks her lips and all that. Anyway, they have a name for her that's not very nice. And it's just among her clients. Well, somehow this works its way to her. And she screams, raging around the office, that I should be called. And of course, the more I say it, the funnier it gets. And it's completely crude. It's just second graders. It's 8-year-old boys snickering at words. But everyone everyone except perhaps my relatives think it's funny. And I felt like I needed a note of puerility in the midst of sometimes a more sophisticated comedy.
In a scene like this, which you're the author and you love that scene, clearly, and it's worked. But if you're you're editing or working with somebody else who's written a scene like this that they're deeply in love with, that in your mind doesn't need some work or doesn't work. So the question is, how do you edit comedy or help somebody who might have the germ of an idea of something that might work?
That's a good question. Some of our recent workshops, we've talked about this. Brevity and pacing is everything in comic writing. Sometimes you have a funny idea, and it would have been, you know, a winning funny idea had it been 2 pages rather than 6 pages. Knowing when to get out of the bit, I'm now sounding like a Catskill stand-up comic, but knowing when the bit's over is very important. Some kind of things are leisurely paced. I think farce needs a long time. Maybe not bathroom humor. Bathroom humor can be a surgical strike, get in, get out, and sex humor and things like that. But I think farce often takes a long time to set up and roll. And I think a certain serene prose describing absurd events is almost all. So many of the great comic writers are great at that kind of thing. This is something the Brits, I think, specialize in. I think about P.G. Woodhouse. You know, there's this wonderful sort of sheen of elegant English over
this
nonsense.
Describing some ridiculous situation.
Right. Evelyn Waugh, just fabulous at this kind of thing. And Cold Comfort Farm, I don't know if you've
read that. But I'll get back. I love this. But get back to your working with some other writer.
It's just timing and pacing, and probably no two writers think the same thing. But I think most writers, if they said that's going on too long, they would immediately take a scissor to it, because we want to be funny and we don't want to be we don't want to lose the timing. Just like telling a joke, there's timing involved in a comic scene.
Well, there's some people who are just you said it earlier that are just naturally funny when they're talking or when they're prompted or in conversation, and then when they try to write it down, they're just not able to do that. Can you help people who got good stories?
I'm not sure I can help people. I'm always getting asked to give a speech. I think I'm going to give a banquet speech at the Writers Network, and people say, "Oh, it's going to be funny." I knew from high school on, when I had some of the student council office, if I had to get up and be funny, I would not be funny. I could just hear the crickets or see the tumbleweeds roll down the aisle as the silence reigned after trying to tell a joke. I could not get up and tell a joke if I had to. However, you put me up on a podium and there's some other more serious or functional reason for my being up there, I can be funny with a situation. And a lot of that's improvisation. But if I had to get up and be funny, if I had to do the Jay Leno style monologue, come out and be funny about current events for 20 minutes before the show began, I would die.
It interested me whether or not Jay Leno could do that by himself. And the question or the topic I'd like to raise is the cooperative development of comedy. At least it's my impression in the classic stand-up night show comedy, that is the product not of an individual, but of a cooperative effort where people bounce it back and forth. And is there a role for that kind of comedy development in what is usually thought of as a lonely process of writing a novel? I mean, maybe I'll get to a question here, Wilton, in a minute.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I'm a great fan of our MFA workshops, but I workshop my stuff. I've been very blessed in having John Kessel and Jill McCorkle, and I made poor Randall Keenan, your professor over here, read a book of mine. I definitely want input. I definitely want people to tell me. And that's the big question I ask. Am I being funny? Is this annoying or is it funny? You know, and if it's going on too long, or I don't quite pick the scab the way I think I'm doing, or it's too acid and coming off bitter. I'm not a bitter person, but you can sometimes come off that way by accident in a comic scene. Then tell me, I will change it. All I need to hear is I didn't laugh, or it went on too long and it's changed. I'm not vain about this. I think that's right. I think that there is room. I wonder how some of the very funny. I wonder how much input any of the Sedarises or Philip Roth, who I think is a terribly funny writer. I wonder how much they run their stuff by people. You know, I'd be curious to know that.
I bet it's different for each one, but it is interesting that some people can deliver the comedy, but they can't make it up. Others can help them make it up, but if you ask them to deliver it, they might not be as good as the person. Yeah. So it's kind of a corporate effort.
Yeah, if Look Away, Look Away is ever made into a HBO has optioned it, and if they ever really make it into a series for HBO, first of all, you know, goodbye, Raleigh. I'll be out in California. We will not be having this conversation, DG. Well, I'll be with my sunglasses by the pool. But
you'll have an open door for your friends to come meet the stars.
You know you can come out and sit by my pool. But one of the comforts, David Miner is one of the guys who is being the producer, and of course he's responsible for Parks and Recreation, 30 Rock. He's touched a number of really great comedies, and comedies have a room full of people screaming out lines. What's the funny? And the funniest line wins. How do you miss? I wish someone would come in my house get a round table full of comic writers shouting out the best lines. And my books would be a lot funnier if we could have that
process. Well, that's the point. Yeah. Why don't you get your focus group to help you develop the comic scenes in your book? I mean, you say, oh, that it wouldn't be mine if I did that.
Well, I don't care about that. I think that the if you give me a great line this afternoon, it's going in the book, and my name's on the book. Don't you doubt.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Wilton Barnhart, who's teaches creative writing in the or teaches writing in the MFA program at North Carolina State University, is the author of the New York Times bestselling Look Away, Look Away. And as we learned in the last segment, it's been optioned by HBO, and we have our fingers crossed.
Sure do.
And you wanted to talk about something else.
When you were talking about the comedy room and advice, one thing my editor, George Whitty, at St. Martin's Press said, when I handed this in originally, he said, I don't understand why you didn't show the Civil War reenactment. You showed the people at the reenactment. Of course, the whole center of this book
for the people who hadn't read it, it's in Charlotte, and there's this made-up, well, you say it's not made-up exactly, but a made-up battle.
Well, Charlotte wasn't in the Civil War. There's nothing happened in Charlotte. And Stoneman came down and burned a trestle down south of town. And so the father, patriarch in the book, has decided he wants a Civil War reenactment of what was essentially a 15-minute late-in-the-war nothing event, which now spreads over 3 days, and people are wandering around dressed as Robert E. Lee, and it's just a complete farce. And I describe it without actually letting it, in the first draft, without actually letting it play out, and I was sent back to write.
So your editor at your publisher said, hey, this, you got something, instead of cutting everything out, he said, you got something and you haven't.
I thought I was running long, and he said, no, I got to see. I have to say, after all the fuss that's made, I've got to see the reenactment. So, of course, I provided a completely farcical,
a terrible,
paltry. They've got one cannon that they can't keep the wheel on it. I mean, it just is one absurdity after another. But people are sitting there with such a grave expression. This is more sacred earth, right? More sacred territory. The grandeur of the vainglory of the Southern cause. So, of course, there's a lot of comedy to be made out of that. Why I didn't think to do it the first time around, I do not know.
How did he tell you that? How does the editor deal with talent?
We have a very good working relationship, and he said, why isn't it in there? He said, I don't think it's longer than 3 pages. He even told me how long it ought to be, and he was right.
But he's looking at you, and he said, I want a farce. Is he saying, no, or is he one of the Yankees who really wants to see how we really
George
do
Whitty's
it?
George Whitty's a graduate, sir, of University of North Carolina. So he enjoyed, I think, that first chapter appealed to him immensely. He was not in a fraternity. No, he saw that it was a missing comic note that had been prepared for, and I glided over it. It wasn't like I didn't have something there. I just didn't have the full farcical scene that you might expect me to write.
But we're out of time.
Yeah.
And I should have gotten to this a long time ago, but I mean, people want you to have rules. Are you going to have rules at your workshop? You're going to say, here are 2 or 3 things. You forget everything else in the workshop, but remember these things when you're talking about comedy. Have you got something like
that? I'm going to do something like that. I'm going to have a great handout, which I haven't prepared yet, but I also thought we'd have an exercise where I have a very dry scene and I'm going to have them humor it up. And see what we get. We'll have 50 entries, and we'll take the best out of each, and we'll have a really successful comic scene before we're
any
done.
But is there one rule? Keep this in mind when you're writing comedy. Guidepost.
Okay. Well, I suppose if I have to have a rule, it's keep the voice sympathetic no matter what you do. The eye of the narrator. Think Twain, think Roth, think, you know, somebody. This is a sensibility that we don't think is cruel or we don't think is evil, but is commenting on things that are evil and cruel. Voice is probably the final stop on the line for the comic writer. The voice has to be winning. There has to be some charm, no matter how awful your thing, no matter how slapstick, no matter how banal, there has to be some thread of charm in which we want to keep turning the pages and spend time with this voice that's telling us these stories.
Well, Wilton Barnhart, thanks. Thanks for coming and giving us a preview of your workshop at the Writers' Conference in November in Charlotte. And, of course, thanks for Look Away, Look Away.
It's always fun to talk to you, D.G.
Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.